are listening to Benjamin Walker's Theory of Everything.
At Radiotopia, we now have a select group of amazing supporters that help us make all our shows possible. If you would like to have your company or product sponsor this podcast, then get in touch. Drop a line to sponsor@radiotopia.fm. Thanks. I read a lot of books about the CIA while working on my recent miniseries, Not All Propaganda Is Art. And a lot of the best ones were written by the same guy, the intelligence scholar Hugh Wilford. In fact, I spoke to him about two of the three main characters in my series, Dwight MacDonald and Richard Wright. Hugh Wilford did seminal research into the CIA's relationship with both men. Hugh Wilford has just published another book on the CIA. This one is about the early years of the organization. It's a group biography that focuses on some of the agency's most seminal figures, men like Kim Roosevelt, Edward Lansdale, and James Angleton. The book is called The CIA and Imperial History, and it's about America's paradoxical relationship with empire. Paradox that affects all of the men in this group biography. Like all of his other books, this one is incredible. I can't recommend it enough. And I thought I would invite Hugh Wilford back on to The Theory of Everything to talk about it.
Thank you, Benjamin. Yes. Yeah, the CIA was originally founded not to carry out coups or stabilize pro-American regimes. It was originally founded as an intelligence gathering and analyzing organization. But as the Cold War escalated in the years after World War II, and in particular those parts of the world that had been colonies of the European powers and were decolonizing, increasingly in play in the Cold War, the CIA was charged with this mission of carrying out covert action in the former European colonies. And that mission really conflicted profoundly, I think, with the anti-imperial convictions of a number of the individuals concerned, who were idealists. They were anti-imperialists. They wanted to help uplift what they called the Third World, what we prefer to call the Global South. But there was this conflict between that impulse and the kind of covert action mission to promote American power in the world, with which the agency was increasingly charged by successive post-war U.S. presidents.
You know, you point out that the Cold War moment almost pushed CIA officers, some of these idealists that you just mentioned, into neo-colonial roles. It almost, you know, when you look at these stories play out, it almost seems predetermined. You know, if you look at the origin stories of some of the early CIA officers, they shared a heritage in typology with their European counterparts. So, you know, it might look like someone like Sherman Kent was stepping reluctantly into this role. It is the very role European men like himself had been stepping into for, you know, centuries. In fact, you point out that the men in his intelligence group, to use one example, all came from this sort of elite background, you know, the same schools, same parochial schools, the same Ivy League schools. And they all even grew up on imperialist literature.
That's right. So there was this missionary impulse within the CIA, which was anti-imperial, sympathetic with the nationalist struggles of colonized peoples. But also there was this other sort of prehistory to the CIA. Many of its early leaders came from this stratum of American society, which was not unlike, you know, European colonial leadership. They'd been sent to New England prep schools, which taught basically British imperial values. Groton School in Massachusetts was perhaps the sort of the archetype of this sort of institution. Its very influential headmaster, Endicott Peabody, had been educated in Britain and absorbed British imperial values like, you know, patriotism, service, also, you know, a desire for sort of proving oneself in overseas adventures. And that was very much the theme of a lot of the sorts of novels that these young men were reading by the likes of Rudyard Kipling and Rider Haggard and John Buchan. So they were sort of reared to look overseas and see it as somewhere where they could go and prove themselves and then return home to the acclaim of their fellow citizens.
You know, some folks might be familiar with some of the characters in your book. You know, Kermit Kim Roosevelt, you know, is famous for his role in the 1953 coup in Iran. And I must admit, I was very surprised to sort of learn in your book that he saw himself as sort of pro-Arab nationalist and anti-colonialist. Yet his very name connects to Kipling. So he seems like a really great example as a character who this paradox really runs through the blood.
He does indeed. You know, if America, right, has produced a great imperialist or one of the presiding personalities of the turn of the 20th century era of new imperialism, it was Teddy Roosevelt. And Kim Roosevelt was a grandson of his. And yes, he's named, as you say, for the Kipling hero, Kim. He's related to the British aristocracy as well through his mother. So he's at Groton. He's a charge of Endicott Peabody. So he's very much absorbed those values in his early life. But he also absorbs some of the sorts of notions that I was talking earlier that come from this other strand feeding into the early CIA, the missionary strand, because he worked for the Office of Strategic Services, the CIA's World War II era predecessor, in Cairo alongside a number of Arabists, Middle Eastern missionary descended Americans, and from them he gains this sympathy for, respect for Arabs and Arab nationalism, anti-Zionism as well, along with other officers, first generation officers in the CIA. He opposes the founding of a Jewish state in Palestine, and he actually, before he joins the CIA in 1949, he actually campaigns for the cause of pro-Arab anti-Zionism. And he carries these values into the agency with him. During the 1950s, he becomes friends with and tries to stabilize the regime of Gamal Nasser after the Egyptian Revolution of 1952. Yet at the same time that he's doing that, he is, as you say, working to overthrow Mohammad Mossadegh, the democratically elected prime minister in Iraq, in this fateful, hugely historically consequential coup. So it seems to me that he really illustrates how this missionary, pro-nationalist, anti-colonial impulse in the CIA lost out spectacularly to the sort of covert imperial mission with which successive administrations, especially the Eisenhower administration, are charging it.
So let's talk about another one of the main characters in your book, the counterinsurgency and psychological warfare expert, Edward Lansdale. On the surface, he, like Kim Roosevelt, seems to be dedicated to anti-imperialism or anti-colonialism. But you want us to see him in a new light as well.
Yeah. So Edward Lansdale, he is not as clearly from the sort of the imperial background of other top CIA officers of his generation, like Kim Roosevelt. He grows up on the West Coast. He's from a sort of much kind of humbler origins. And he explicitly says that he's anti-colonial. He doesn't share the sort of the anti-Asian attitudes of a number of other members of his generation, especially on the West Coast. He very much bases his approach to his covert missions in Asia, which he undertakes first in the Philippines, then in the then in Vietnam during the late 1940s and 1950s. He bases his whole approach on notions of brotherhood and friendship, even love. Other American officials of the period sort of talk about him as if he's kind of like a latter-day missionary, sort of driven by almost a sort of religious zeal. Yet at the back of it always, there's the, when things don't work out like earlier colonialists, he and his operatives are sort of ready to resort to colonial techniques. In fact, the efforts to suppress the communist Hucks in the Philippines, napalm is used there, violence is used there. You know, in Korea, he dislikes French colonial officials, really sort of at a deep kind of visceral level. Yet he ends up working alongside some when in Vietnam in this effort to shore up the anti-communist government there. You know, even in his kind of like personal relations with the Vietnamese and Filipinos, there are echoes of earlier colonial relationships as well. He has a long affair with a Filipino woman, members of his team in Vietnam have similar relationships with and marry Vietnamese women, and you know, there were histories of sexual intimacy in prior colonial history as well. So that, it seems to me that sort of Lansdale is he is not of this kind of imperial set, the Imperial Brotherhood, as one historian has called them. He actually rather dislikes, I think, elements of that approach. Yet even he ends up resorting to colonial era scripts when serving in the Philippines and Vietnam.
So Lansdale has a connection to Graham Greene's film The Quiet American, which I talked about in my recent series, Not All Propaganda is Art. In fact, I concluded the whole series with an examination of this film. He worked with U.S. filmmakers, Mankiewicz, to turn Graham Greene's anti-American novel into a pro-American film. And this really upset Graham Greene, but it really was a spectacular PR move. But it also really lines up with this idea that men like Lansdale just didn't see themselves, or America for that matter, as colonialists.
Yeah, I think Lansdale really continues sincerely to believe this. There's very, you know, having read through his papers and magazine articles that he published, usually, you know, under an assumed name or anonymously, there's very little sense that he is putting on an act here. I think, you know, he believes in the universality of American values. He thinks that he is a genuine friend of Asians, and I think it's there very much in the doctrine of counterinsurgency. He becomes the sort of he's identified as the main American architect of a distinctive U.S. counterinsurgency doctrine, and it's very much based on the notion of, you know, going in to help peoples, build states, create infrastructure, the develop the third world, as that would have been the language in the Cold War era. Yet there is always the possibility of violence, you know, if that tactic doesn't work. So that sort of contradiction, that paradox, is present in earlier colonial efforts to strengthen client governments, and it's there again in the 1950s. But Lansdale never really sort of acknowledges that paradox, that contradiction, and I think that's what kind of enables him to keep going. Even later in his life, he eventually marries the Filipino woman. He had been in a marriage to a sort of very long-suffering American woman, and he effectively sort of deserted her and his children to go on these lengthy overseas missions. She passes, and he's eventually able to marry Pat Kelly, his Filipino lover. Ultimately, you know, if he's really good at something, Edward Lansdale, it's psychological warfare. He has a background in advertising. He was an advertising executive before he joined the OSS and then the CIA. And I think to the extent that, you know, he has successes, and he does undoubtedly, he helped secure the election of Ramon Magsaysay in the Philippines in 1953, which is, you know, a pro-American, truly popular Filipino leader, just the sort that the U.S. was hoping to find in the Third World, and that is a success for Lansdale. But it's really about he helps Magsaysay to the Filipino presidency. I think really, because of his skills at advertising and psychological warfare, you know, writing Magsaysay's speeches and even recording this election jingo, the Magsaysay Mambo, which is still really catchy, actually. And that was a sort of CIA psychological warfare project. The real secret of his success, such as it was his skill at psychological warfare.
Yeah. And that's what I find so provocative about that story, about what he does with the quiet American, because it's almost really gets at so many of the themes from this period. And in your book, this sort of America taking over from the colonial project. And he's able to take this book that, you know, really had a strong anti-American statement to it, Graham Greene's novel, and flip the script. So it was very much a pro-American story. Yeah. And while that is an amazing example of psychological warfare, just because you're able to do that doesn't make it true.
Right.
And it's just, I love it. It's such it feels like it really gets to so much about him and this moment and about what needed to be done and how to advertise or publicize the America we wanted to project into the world.
No, it's super clever. He was good at this sort of thing, right? He takes this anti-American novel, and there's so many ironies around this. He is often identified wrongly, actually, as the real life inspiration for the character Alden Pyle, this kind of bumbling, naive CIA officer in Vietnam at the heart of the narrative, and then sort of stands it on its head to become this kind of pro-American, anti-communist cinematic treatise, which is the 1958 movie, and in the process, you know, really angering Graham Greene, understandably.
Another character in your book is the man who basically built the CIA's counterintelligence operation, James Angleton, a man very famous for his paranoia. And I was so fascinated to learn how central paranoia was or played in the Imperial project itself. And for me, this is one of the most interesting arguments in your book, you sort of tracing the connections between our own paranoia, or their roots, perhaps is a better word, in the Imperial project itself.
Yes. He's often described as paranoid, James Angleton, because he's the guy who he established basically CIA counterintelligence. He has this sort of reputation as counterintelligence genius, and you know, he is very accomplished, He does many impressive things, but later in his career, he becomes obsessed with this notion that the CIA has been penetrated by a Soviet mole, and the hunt for the mole becomes increasingly disruptive and destructive. It, you know, forces a number of people to resign. He shouldn't have had to have resigned. It spreads overseas. It affects intelligence organizations in Canada and in Britain as well. And you know, people have tried to explain why Angleton took this kind of paranoid turn. And you know, some people have speculated that he was, you know, psychiatrically a clinical case of paranoia. I wondered if it wasn't, again, something to do with this prehistory of imperialism that I think is an important part of the CIA's context. Angleton is a sort of archetypal member of this kind of quasi-imperial set that's running the CIA in its early days. He's actually been educated in Britain at a British private school or public school, of course, as they're known, Malvern College. And he very much, I think, absorbs British values. And among those are this thing that historians, apart from me, have called imperial paranoia. It's condition of empires, really, is that you're trying to exercise power over these, you know, vast foreign territories, trying to gather intelligence about them. It's an extremely difficult assignment, and it makes you overly sensitive to some threats, usually foreign manipulation. The British were, this is going back again to the Great Game and the rivalry with Tsarist Russia in Afghanistan and India. You know, the British were constantly paranoid about Russian meddling and tended to blame local nationalist movements on Russian meddling. When in fact, of course, often, you know, anti-colonial nationalism had genuine local roots, right? So there is this hypersensitivity to communist intervention in particular. And I mean, which isn't to say, of course, you know, that there is communist meddling, but there is also this tendency to exaggerate it and blame all sort of adverse local events on it. And I think Angleton inherits that tendency from his days in Britain. And I think that it's that then sort of explains the descent into this kind of mania about communist penetration of the CIA, which affects him in his later years.
So all this paranoia that comes with or from America's paradoxical relationship with empire leads to what you call a number of unintended consequences. And I think maybe we could conclude by talking about some of those.
Yeah, and I think if you look at Angleton and the history of American counterintelligence and its involvement in various domestic operations in which it really shouldn't have engaged, you know, monitoring, surveilling the new left during the 1960s in an operation called MH Chaos. For me, it doesn't explain it all, but part of what's going on in the background there is that you have this kind of imperial organization, this spy agency sort of doing the work of American empire overseas, and that there is this long American historical tradition of anti-imperialism, and that is, I think, the anti-Vietnam War movement of the 1960s, I think, is in many ways it's possible to read that as a kind of another expression of this longer history of American anti-imperialism. So for me, that's kind of the background to some of the more questionable activities that the CIA becomes involved in, and that Angleton's counterintelligence unit within the CIA kind of is particularly involved in during the 1960s and 1970s. It's kind of, it's this longer struggle in American life going on between the forces of empire and anti-imperialism, right? For me, that helps explain events like MH chaos in sort of larger historical terms. And then finally, it seems to me that a lot of sort of America's recent tendency toward conspiracy theory is down to the growth of organizations like the CIA, this kind of massive expansion of secret government machinery during the years of the Cold War, and now more recently the War on Terror, that has generated, to some extent, understandable popular anxiety about and suspicion of what the government is doing.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite arguments in the book, and I think it's important to distinguish this conspiracyism that you're talking about from, you know, what other historians have called, say, the paranoid style of American politics. You really seem to be drawing a through line from the conspiracy embedded in imperialism that you just talked about with Angleton, sort of that sort of boomeranging back, or say, to put it in your words, the post-colonial conspiracism didn't stay in the post-colonial world.
Yes. Local populations in countries that had once been colonies and then become sites of the Cold War struggle for supremacy, they are prone to conspiracism as well. You know, suspicion of foreign spies pulling the strings of all local events. You know, in India, there's a lot of conspiracism in modern Indian political culture, and I think some of this kind of bleeds back into U.S. culture via the anti-imperial left within the U.S., which is very sort of open to the influence of post-colonial leaders. So it was very noticeable for me that all my sort of main characters that I'd written about in earlier chapters about, you know, U.S. counterinsurgency overseas and cooperation such as Roosevelt's in Iran, that almost all of those characters then later became the focus of CIA conspiracy theories. Edward Lansdale, he has been fingered by many Kennedy conspiracy theorists as behind JFK's assassination. Who else? James Angleton, of course. He is also suspected of playing a role in Kennedy's death. Also, the murder, the unsolved murder a year later of Mary Pinchot Meyer, who has also been the wife of another top CIA operative called Meyer, who headed the CIA's domestic and another publicity or propaganda campaigns. So that is her death, this unsolved murder on a Georgetown canal path in 1964 is also wrapped up in she was having an affair with JFK. So, you know, as so often with conspiracy theories, you know, there is enough basis in fact for people to be able to sort of spin, you know, grand conspiratorial theories out of it. All you really need is kind of like, to some extent, this kind of this bleeding of I think foreign conspiracism back into American culture, and the paranoid style as well, you know, America's historic tendency toward conspiracy theory, just to sort of add fuel to the fire.
But this is, it's a very problematic sort of quicksand, because, you know, you just brought up Cord Meyer. I had the pleasure of getting to talk to you about two of the characters in my recent series, Not All Propaganda Is Art series, both Dwight MacDonald and Richard Wright. And Cord Meyer is kind of the man who ties them together, in that he was the CIA officer responsible for propaganda operations like Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty and the Congress for Cultural Freedom. And one of the things I took away from working on this story, something that, you know, is very strengthened in your new book, is that when you look at all these operations in total, you can't help but be amazed at how impactful and influential they were. In other words, yes, we can laugh at, you know, what, you know, possibly could have been accomplished by an abstract expressionism exhibit in Paris or a free jazz concert in Nigeria. But, you know, when you add everything up that Kordmeier was sort of responsible for in this period. It's quite impressive, and in a way, you know, it's quite fair to say that these conspiracy theories come out of this.
Yes, it's a huge intervention in domestic American life that's going on. You know, many millions of dollars involved in as we've discussed before, as you say, in the arts in particular. You know, a part of American culture which often is starved of funding. So this sudden injection of huge amounts of cash is bound to have a huge impact. And I think it does contribute undoubtedly to American popular support for interventions in foreign countries during the Cold War. Yet at the same time, partly because of American anti-imperialism, because of American democracy, you know, it's difficult, I think, being a secret organization in America, right? People are always trying to find out what you're doing. The CIA doesn't always achieve what it actually sets out to do. It's sometimes actually, I think, the opposite of what it sets out to do.
Well, let's leave it at that for now. Once again, thanks, Hugh Wilford, for coming on the show to talk with us about your new book.
It's been a pleasure, Benjamin. Thank you for inviting me.
Hugh Wilford is the author of The CIA, An Imperial History, out now from Basic Books. The Theory of Everything is produced by me, Benjamin Walker. You can find links to Hugh Wilford's book, as well as Not All Propaganda is Art, the nine-plus-hour miniseries that we just put out a few months ago, on the website, theoryofeverythingpodcast.com.
Radiotopia.